Ding dong. The witch is gone.
But what is at the door?
What is at the door?
That's always the question when something may...
The Pinkertons.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, they're following her out.
They are following her out?
Yeah.
Are they?
Maybe. I mean...
I feel like that's...
I think
they're on speed dial still.
Oh, well.
They were a contractor, probably. Hopefully. Hopefully.
Look, all I'm saying is hopefully the next person understands, like, a lawyer's probably enough to scare most people.
Genuinely, though. Like, not even a lawyer, just a poorly drafted cease and desist is more than enough.
They've been sending those for years. I don't know why this had to change.
I don't know, man. I don't know. The literal Pinkertons are crazy. That's absolutely wild. Obviously, you've seen the title of the podcast. Cynthia Williams, the president of Wizards of the Coast, after a little over 2 years, she's amicably resigning, but probably being told to resign.
Yeah, we've had some heavy air quotes probably around that, if you would like.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that later. We also have some changes for Daggerheart. They've done some revisions, some updates, which is very fun, and then some Baldur's Gate ridiculousness, including some 50th anniversary pre-release stuff for Commander Legends, Battles for Baldur's Gate, and we'll get into some magic leaks and all that kind of stuff, too. But we want to start off this episode of the podcast, episode 65 of the Duels and Mana Dorks podcast, as we always do, and introduce ourselves. I'm Connor.
And I'm Sam.
We are the Dungeon Bros, but we are not brothers.
Nor are we in a dungeon.
Yes. Yes, yes. I would like to have a dungeon one day.
Someday. I mean, we do have a...
basement.
A half basement, because half of it is underground, half of it's our garage.
Yeah, and the half that's just basement part is also half litter box.
Yes.
So...
it's a lot of... It's a surprising amount of litter box.
Let's call quarter litter box. That one quarter of the room.
Yeah.
Like if you were to...
It's still a surprising amount of litter box for one cat.
Yeah, she's very persnickety about her boxes.
Yes.
Yeah. Technically, she has four in the house. One of them's in my room. But
the other three are just lined up next to each other in the basement.
Yeah, because she'll use one once, and then if she needs to use a litter box again before I've had a chance to empty them, it'll just be on the floor.
Yeah.
Sometimes even, when the litter boxes are completely clean and fresh with clean new litter, she'll sit on the floor anyway. So, anyway,
I had a cat growing up that he was an indoor outdoor cat. He would go outside to poop, and he would dig a little hole, and he'd poop, and then he'd cover it up.
Good for him.
Right?
That's very convenient. That's also what litter boxes are trying to emulate.
Yeah.
And we need to be patient with our cats in the litter boxes, because at the end of the day, they're doing us a great favor by being trained to shit in a very specific location.
What about those cats who learn to shit in the toilet?
That is so unnecessarily difficult to do, because you need to get one of those litter boxes that sits in a toilet seat, and then you need to get other litter boxes that have holes in the middle, and the holes just get larger and larger and larger so that they learn more and more how to shit just into a hole. That's a whole other conversation to have, but enough of that bullshit. I want to thank, of course, Proxy Forge for sponsoring this episode of the Duels and Mana Dorks podcast. Proxy Forge makes high-quality Magic the Gathering proxies. Custom art from our friend Tyler. You can use the link in our bio, the Beacons link in the bio at the top, and you use that link, and you get some cool Proxy Forge proxies. It'll help us out, and it helps out the show quite a bit.
He's been going wild recently, got a bunch of new products, and
yes.
he has more coming out with every set of Magic the Gathering.
Yes, he does. One of the favorite things for me is the pre-con upgrade packs, mm-hmm. where you get an alternate art for the commander, as well as cards that would be way too expensive, probably, or just weren't included in Commander Precons, and it's just a nice little, technically 9-card upgrade. Sometimes I believe that he just has a fancy command tower as well, but it's still a very reasonable price compared to what those cards would be as real cards, as singles, and you would never see a lot of those cards in Precons, so it's a nice way to kind of zhuzh up a pre-con. I got he sent us a bunch of cards,
mm-hmm.
and one of the packs that he sent us was for the Kaust disguise pre-con for Murders at Karlov Manor, and I used a lot of those to help zhuzh up my Yaris Roar of the Old Gods deck, which slapped on our Monday Night Magic, where we play Magic the Gathering every Monday night. We're trying to move to YouTube. Right now it's kind of low priority compared to podcasty things, so we'll get there. The TikTok Live, man. The TikTok live, it hurts. It hurts the soul sometimes. Everything around TikTok kind of hurts right now.
You know, it's been...
Even the government.
The government's been salty for a while, let's be fair.
But before we get into the various spiels, I just want to pull up Ryan over at Playing With Power. Playing With Power is a CEDH gameplay YouTube channel. They've been going for a while. They have a very successful Patreon. They're very popular in the community. I've met Ryan a couple of times at SCGCon. He has some mutual friends, and I've played a game of CEDH with him. The first and only, so far, game of CEDH that I've ever played. He let me pilot his Godot deck, trying to get the... Oh my god, the
Godot, Helm of the Host combo.
Yeah, Helm of the Host combo for infinite combats and winning, which I did, which was awesome. Yes. He sent out kind of a cryptic tweet yesterday, and this is also on his community tab for his YouTube channel, saying, "Big changes have just come up in my personal life. The channel is being put on an indefinite hold. I don't know when it will be back, if at all. Sorry for such a short notice. I have a paused Patreon. I'll have more updates at a later time." Obviously something quite serious is happening, and whatever that is, I want to wish him well and offer our support in any way. And please, if you like Playing With Power, go send some love. And if you've been watching Playing With Power for a while and you're kind of on the fence about getting sleeves, they have cool sleeves. Where is my... You can get very cool custom sleeves and play mats and all that kind of stuff, Playing With Power, if you want to support them. He is pausing the Patreon, which by the way, there's a lot of creators out there that have crowdfunding things like Patreon, and if they go on an extended break, they just kind of like, oh, I'll keep collecting the money, and they just don't say anything.
Yeah.
Or they say like, oh, I'm going on a break, and then they just continue to collect the money anyway. So big, big props to him for doing the... what I would say is the morally correct thing, and being like, yeah, I'm going to stop letting you guys give me money since I know I'm not going to be able to produce for you.
Yeah, I feel like there's so much advice out there these days on how to be a creator that, and a lot of it probably would involve around, hey, you know, if you're going on break, you don't have to say anything, and you don't have to pause your Patreon. So to see another creator who is caring about their community enough to, follow, to do what's right for their community when they're doing what's right for themselves.
Yeah.
It's very nice to see. We really respect people, the guys that were playing Power, Ryan and his others, friends who he works with. So,
yeah. We highly recommend go checking out their stuff. You can watch most all of their content for free on YouTube. So, Godspeed to them. But... Let's get into our normal pre-show spiel. Sam, what have you been playing recently in the world of... Have you been playing anything in the world of tabletop RPGs? In Magic the Gathering?
So...
Vidya games?
So, last time, I picked back up Doom. Beat Doom. Got a lot of the achievements. Can't get all of them. I do like to achievement hunt from time to time.
I do. It has to be the right game.
Doom is a lot of fun. And I'm pretty much down to just the multiplayer achievements, which it's a 2016 game. So the people that are playing nowadays are tryhards. No offense to any tryhards out there. I'm
a little bit of offense to the tryhards.
But I'm not going to get those. Actually, but more, I had an interesting discussion this weekend based around a game that neither of us, I don't think, have played. Have you ever played Dead by Daylight?
No, but I've heard very good things.
Yeah, so I haven't either. I played, right around the time Dead by Daylight came out, a bunch of those horror games came out. I think Friday the 13th also came out, and some others. But anyway, so I went to a Tough Mudder this weekend, drove down with a couple of our friends, and one of our friends, a new friend of mine, she said she's pretty big into Dead by Daylight, been playing for a couple years now since it came out, and we were talking, and it kind of came out that she kind of told me about this interesting, or I drew the comparison to Magic, to Commander format in particular, in the way that Dead by Daylight community also works. So in our...
Interesting.
Yeah, so in Commander, of course, it's a little different than a one-on-one format, since, you know, the goal for a casual Commander pot isn't for necessarily one person to drive hard to the win immediately. That's more in a CEDH realm or a competitive realm.
Yeah.
In a casual Commander pod, it's more of like, okay, let's feel out the game. How are we doing power levels? You know, what do we kind of want to get from this game? Well, apparently in Dead by Daylight, So in Dead by Daylight, you have two teams. You have the killer, a single player who's, you know, more of the arch enemy of the game, and then four survivors.
Yeah, like an asymmetric multiplayer game.
An asymmetric multiplayer game. And the way that there's an entire part of the community that Dead by Daylight is naturally a ranked game.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's no casual, there's no pubs. But there is a code of ethics that the community has placed around it. And also the creators of the game, I don't know who they are, I don't know who the producer is, but there's a terms of service. In the terms of service, they've included basically two rules, as far as I understand, for the killer.
Five Games Behavior Interactive is the developer, by the way.
There we go. But so what my friend was telling me is she was saying that there is a code of ethics and a terms of and part of the terms of service is to follow that code of ethics, which for the killer includes no camping and no tunneling is what they call it. So in Dead by Daylight, the goal is to knock down the survivors and then put them on a hook.
Mm-hmm.
And then the survivor bleeds out from there. In terms of service, it literally says that the killer should not be camping
the person on the hook
or on the ground. And she says a lot of the time there's not an issue with this. Like during
except for the times there is.
Except for when because they have their ranked reset every month on the 13th.
So I bet the 10th to the 13th is just...
Yeah, she said, and I found that very interesting because we used to play Apex.
Yes.
Played Apex, Warzone. Warzone, thank you. And all of those, like, if you're playing, you're expected, and especially ranked, you're expected to be playing the optimal strategy.
Yeah, or
close to one.
Close to one. There's meta games. You don't want to be playing something actively off meta if you can avoid it.
And so it's very interesting to me that technically this strategy of camping a downed survivor would be the meta or the optimal strategy, but because of the way that the game itself is formatted and the way that the developers aren't implementing a mechanical way to prevent this, it's very interesting that this community has come around and said this is how the game should be played.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of those community taking ownership of a game that they very much enjoy. The only reason that Dead by Daylight is as popular as it is like it had very little marketing push. It's honestly quite an old game as well. So like the community is the one that's keeping it alive. So they probably reached the point in the game's life cycle where it's like, all right, whatever the community wants. Destiny 2 is kind of at that point right now where you can just kind of have and do everything at this point. You can mix and match all the skills. You can do literally anything now because they're getting to the end of the life cycle of that game. But that's fun.
Yeah.
Didn't know anything.
It's very interesting that compared to what Helldivers 2 is doing with having constant updates to rebalance things and asking the community very directly, what do you want?
Dude, Helldivers 2 is like, it could be a masterclass in video games and just gaming in general, public relations and marketing. Like they're doing a fantastic job there.
They're doing great.
Continuing to slowly work my way through Persona 5 in my leisure. Also still working my way through Final Fantasy VII Remake, which is fun. We played Outlaws of Thunder Junction last night for our Monday Night Magic live stream. We took some pre-release kits for Outlaws of Thunder Junction and pitted them against each other. I was doing Boros, mercenaries, just kind of aggro.
Yeah.
And you had like a Naya saddles.
Naya mount, yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty fun. I think we might be doing... I think it would be smart to do the pre-release stuff a little bit different. Since it's a live stream and we're taking a week to build decks anyway, like, we'll just play with the cards we got.
Yeah.
And we can be like, oh, I have this card that's 5 cents that works really good with yours that you didn't get, so you could just use that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a 10-cent card that works really well, and I'm just going to use that. And then, like, actually kind of build somewhat more optimal decks that play a little bit better.
Yeah.
Just because I feel like we both find ourselves kind of on certain games getting stuck, not being able to really do much.
Yeah.
I think that would just be more entertaining as well. I also, as I mentioned, I built the Yaris Roar of the Old Gods deck. That's a gruel, disguise, morph, manifest deck. He is a very good card.
Yeah.
Yharis, Roar of the Old Gods is a very, very good card.
I mean, just at, for, well, I mean, just let alone, just alone a haste enabler in the command zone, great.
Mm-hmm.
And then also gives you card draw, also gives you recursion and continuous creature entering the battlefield effects.
Yes, and it's so, like, Impact Tremors was a very important card in one of our games. And it's not, and it's something that I like, oh, I knew that was going to be useful because I have a lot of cost reducers for creatures since morph and disguised cards are colorless creatures. They mm-hmm. are, they enter the battlefield as a creature. They cost 3 mana. It doesn't matter what color the mana is. So getting enough cost reducers out, like, I could just be free casting them if things went crazy.
Yeah.
And so just one interaction that I didn't fully realize when I put Impact Tremors in was when a disguised or morphed or manifested a face-down creature
mm-hmm.
dies while Yharis is on the battlefield, it returns to the battlefield, so it re-enters the battlefield face-down and then flips up for free. That's the biggest one, is that I'm getting the flipping face-up without having to pay the disguise and morph and yeah. manifest costs, which makes it way more efficient. But is a fun deck, and it's also very different than any of the other decks that I've made, which was one of my goals with this. I'm also almost complete with my Abdel Adrian Gorion's Ward and Candlekeep Sage background commander, Azorius blinking nonsense, another strategy that I've not really done much before, and I anticipate that one to be very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It does, that combination of commander and background does see some EDH play at a lower level. It's not nearly as powerful as like the top tier decks.
Sure.
And obviously I'm not building it as a CDH list. Like I'm not throwing a bunch of fucking mana vaults and moxes in there and all this high tier shit. Even though I could with all the Proxy Forge proxies we have, but, I'm running it just kind of more value based, just blinking constant, like, basically have an answer for anything by blinking my commander is the kind of thing, and then eventually having a ridiculous board state of 1/1 soldiers that I can then swing out with. So yeah, I'm excited to get that one online as well, because I think that'll be very, very fun. Yeah, that's kind of all we got. Of course, let's get into the rundown of the upcoming releases. Before we do, though, the Duels and Mana Dorks podcast, it goes live every other week on Wednesday at 12:30 Eastern Time. That posting date might change in the near future when the Patreon gets updated, which would be quite nice. But you can get it, of course, on podcast services around the globe, Apple, Google, Spotify, YouTube Music. We also post the video version of the podcast on our YouTube channel. We use that to make shorts and clips as well. You can follow us on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, Discord, all the various things. Monday Night Magic live streams, we talked about all that already. But Sam, what are the upcoming releases for Dungeons & Dragons and Magical Gathering and Daggerheart?
I guess so. So first off, we have Vecna, Eve of Ruin. That'll be available on D&D Beyond and from your local game store on May 7th with a full retail release on May 21st. That will also come with Vecna, Nest of the Eldritch Eye, which is a prequel adventure for lower levels, available with all pre-orders for $5 on D&D Beyond. Next up, not an adventure, but a coffee table book, The Making of Original D&D, 1970 to 1976. That'll be available on June 18th. And finally, the anthology for this year, Quest from the Infinite Staircase, D&D Beyond, and the local game store release will be on July 9th, with the full release a week later on July 16th.
I will say, Vecna, Eve of Ruin, they've been ramping up the marketing for that a lot lately. They've been doing a lot of videos on the official Dungeons & Dragons YouTube channel with Chris Perkins and all of them. It is looking like it's going to be that adventure that we kind of all want it to be. It's yeah. like a big send-off for 5e. It looks like it's going to be very, very fun. It's been a while since we've bought some D&D books with purpose.
Yeah, we've been
I'm quite interested in this, in the Vecna Eve of Ruin, and if I am, I probably should be pre-ordering it pretty soon to get the Vecna Nest of the Eldritch Eye on D&D Beyond for free instead of spending $5. So yeah, and also Quest from the Infinite Staircase is going to be fantastic. All the anthology books we have no reason to think they're going to be bad at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
They have a fantastic track record.
Next up, we have the 1D&D, or the new 5th edition, the 2024 revision. The Player's Handbook will come out on September 17th. The DMG will come out 2 months later on November 12th. And then the Monster Manual will come out February 18th of 2025.
We criticized the 1D&D releases for being so spread out, and I still want to criticize it for that a bit, but the 5e releases were also spread out. But they were like a month apart.
Yeah, they were several. Much closer.
They were much, much closer. But
of course, in this instance, you know, you're still supposed to be able to use the 2014 revisions or edition to play. You know, it's supposed to be simpatico, compatible with the 1D&D updates. But next up, we have the Magic: The Gathering. We have Outlaws of Thunder Junction is out now. Go pick that up at your local game store.
Yes, please do. A lot of the cards are very good.
Oh, yeah. A lot of good cards. Very, very good. Talked about them last podcast episode.
Those spree cards are going to be fucking cracked for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. Those fit into so many places. But next up in June, on June 7th, we have the pre-release of Modern Horizons 3, with the full release 1 week later on June 14th.
Yes, we have some leaked cards, the Flipwalker archetype cards that have been leaked that we'll go over later in the podcast.
Then in July, on July 5th, we'll have the Assassin's Creed Universes Beyond boosters available.
Yeah, the seven card booster packs.
Next, we'll have the Bloomburrow. The pre-release for Bloomburrow will be July 26th, with the full release on August 2nd. And then finally this year, we'll have Duskmourn, House of Horrors. That will be available in Q4 of this year.
Mm. We also have Daggerheart on this list, but we don't have an official release date. It's still in beta. You can have like all the available stuff for free.
They did just put out, we'll go into this in a little bit, they did just put out their first rules update.
The major rule, technically they had a 1.2 version, but it was like correcting spelling mistakes and clarifications things like right after it was released. 1.3 has some significant rules changes to it, though. We'll go over that. But we will dawdle no longer. There's big news in the world of Wizards of the Coast. Wizards of the Coast president Cynthia Williams is departing Wizards of the Coast at the end of the month. She is leaving the company. The SEC filed an SEC filing disclosed that Cynthia Williams, president of Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro Gaming, had informed Hasbro that she will be leaving the company as of April 26th, that is 3 days from the recording of this podcast. Per the SEC filing, Hasbro is conducting a process to identify her successor, quote, looking at both internal and external candidates, end quote. When reached out for comment, Rascal News was the... Reaching out for comment to Wizards of the Coast, they say, quote, we're excited for Cynthia to take the next step in her career and grateful to her contributions she has made in her more than 2 years at Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro. We wish her the absolute best in her next endeavor, and we have started the search for the new president of Wizards of the Coast and hope to have a successor in place soon. This was first reported by Rascal News when they found the SEC filing themselves. Cynthia Williams joined Wizards of the Coast just over 2 years ago, joining Hasbro from Microsoft, where she took over Chris Cox, who is currently the CEO of Hasbro, who was previously the president of Wizards of the Coast. And since then, who doggy has it been a clusterfuck at Wizards of the Coast, overseeing the Aftermath boosters nonsense, the Pinkertons, the layoffs for Wizards of the Coast she was instrumental in. She's talked an awful lot of shit about the staff at Wizards of the Coast in various meetings, and clearly doesn't have a firm grasp of the financial situation of Wizards of the Coast, what's actually making them money.
We've been talking about this for years, where, you know, one of the very first things that we saw from Cynthia Williams in public, you know, in public statements was, yeah, D&D is under-monetized. We don't want it to be a seasonal purchase. We want it to be a continuous spending environment. That along with, you know, even just at the end of last year during their financial reportings, during a meeting, it was reported that she asked somebody, oh, aren't we failing at basically, paraphrasing here, aren't we failing? And they go, no. And she goes, you're wrong.
We are failing. It's like, we're exceptionally profitable. We're actually the thing that's keeping Hasbro afloat. That is the one major thing that she has done successfully, is that Wizards of the Coast is exceptionally profitable.
Yeah.
To the point that some might say it's oversaturated. And if you look at the most recent earnings reports for the last two quarters, with the next one coming out tomorrow, which will be the day that this podcast is released, we don't have the next earnings reports for quarter 1 of 2024 yet. But, actually, no, I believe it's quarter 4 that they're going to release at toward the end of quarter 1, and then they'll compile all the quarter 1 stuff and release it at the end of quarter 2. Is that how that works?
Well, quarter 1's already over. Quarter 1 ends in March.
Ends in March? Oh, right. Duh. Duh. I was thinking, I was doing my division of 12 wrong. Oh.
Math is for blockers.
Yeah, so this is literally, I don't block in Magic. The quarter 4 and quarter 2, quarter 3 earnings of 2023 were both increasingly down, and I imagine that her resigning is either her response before the public release or the board of Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro telling her she needs to resign before the public release of the earnings, which I suspect is going to be quite down even more.
Yeah, if they're... I mean, they had a lot of, there was a lot of success attributed last year, especially to the Lord of the Rings Magic the Gathering set, and also then Baldur's Gate 3 by Larian Studios.
Very big releases, made a lot of money, and Wizards of the Coast is still by far the most profitable part of Hasbro. But then you look at the layoffs, and obviously she would be having input on who on her team would be being laid off. And then you look at the choices that were being made.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're going to be laying off the lead of your Universes Beyond section of the company, the section that's by far been the most profitable part between Warhammer and Doctor Who and Lord of the Rings and countless Secret Lairs. Oh my God, the change to Secret Lairs being a limited run as opposed to a print-to-order product. You can't get Secret Lairs anymore unless you buy them immediately, which is what they want you to do. They don't want you to analyze whether or not it's something that you want. They want you to just get it.
Yeah. I just saw another article based around this, but in that article they talked to the head of Larian Studios, who was saying, you know, their overall Larian Studios' overall experience working with Wizards of the Coast was fine. They, you know, the people that they were working with were great. But now, after especially after these layoffs that happened at the end of last year, he said that there's no one left there of the original team they were working with. You know, of course, Baldur's Gate 3 was in development for years and years and years and years. So of course, some people move on. But he's like, yeah, now after those layoffs, there's just no one, and that's maybe contributed to why they decided to move on with their productions.
Yeah, we're actually just gonna jump to this now. I was gonna do it later, but Larian Studios, the publisher for Baldur's Gate 3, this was gonna be part of the wrap up. They have announced that they do not intend to make another sequel for the Baldur's Gate franchise and want to move on to a different product entirely. Wizards of the Coast, in response to that, of course, said that they were going to be shopping out the Baldur's Gate IP to other developers to see who would want to make a Baldur's Gate 4. But Larian Studios stepping away after probably the most successful D&D game that's ever been made.
Oh, yeah.
By far, and also one that kind of took the world by storm for 2023, even though it was released in August.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it quickly rose through the ranks. I mean, it won so many awards last year. People, everyone who's anyone on TikTok was like, well, I just spent the last month of my life consecutively peeing in my pants while I romanced, while I romanced Asterion.
Yeah, that is something. But it, Cynthia, I would say it's sad to see you go, but it's not. Don't let the door hit your ass on the way out. And who would we like to be president of Wizards of the Coast at this point? Because I think there are a couple that would do a fantastic job, but obviously they would not be looking to them, probably, because they're more creative types.
I was going to say, any of the head designers of Magic or D&D.
I would love Chris Perkins.
Yeah.
I would unironically love Chris Perkins to be the president. He would fix so much shit, I think.
But I assume it's going to be somebody that we've never heard of, because we don't, you know the higher-ups in the New York Times electronic distribution channel.
Yeah,
it's going to be somebody like that.
It's going to be some fucking person you've never heard of that's going to milk it for all it's worth. I think it would be very smart. You need to have a mix at these companies.
Mm-hmm.
You need a bean counter. in charge of things in some way. You need someone who's looking at the financials and making sure that everything is profitable. And I think having someone like a Chris Cox, like a Cynthia Williams, somewhere in the mix is important.
Sure, absolutely.
But when it's just those people, you get the situation that we find ourselves in now, where Hasbro is bleeding money. The one thing that's holding them afloat is now being milked for more and more and squeezed so tight that suddenly now their products aren't as good anymore, which means they're not as efficient at stemming the bleeding from Hasbro, which makes them want to squeeze even more out of them. Yeah. And it's just creating a vicious cycle of problems. And you need those creatives that are like, we need to push back a little bit and have a certain level of quality with our products that makes people want to buy them so that we can stay profitable in the long term without just trying to get everything out of it that we possibly can.
And also, I think a big one is going to be the awareness of the community. And as we mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, there's a company that right now is doing that wonderfully, and that's the Helldivers 2 creators. And with Cynthia in charge, that was when the OGL debacle first happened.
Oh my god. Yeah. I forgot about that. That in her defense, she took over in February of 2022, which oh, wait, yeah, that was 2023 to 2024.
Yeah.
Shit. All right, yeah, that was her. Of course that was.
So, yeah,
of course
and then just, you know, the PR team for Wizards of the Coast was just having...
2022 to 2023. Carry. I got the dates wrong. Carry on.
She came... Yes. So the PR team was having to do backbends in order to try to fix relations with the community. So hopefully whoever comes in at least can identify, can look at the trends of the past couple of years and see where not to put their foot in their mouth.
Literally.
Like,
literally.
It's a company. They're going to make mistakes. Just make ones that are forgivable by the community or ways that you can make it up to the community without mm-hmm. having to entirely backtrack on the thing you were doing.
Aftermath boosters.
Yeah.
OGL. The Aftermath boosters, they were so all in on that it's been fucking up sets since then.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the reason that there ended up being two bonus sheets for Outlaws of Thunder Junction.
And now those cards are like impossible to get at a reasonable price because when you have a one slot where you can get list cards, you can get special guest cards in the list slot, you can get you have an entire other bonus sheet of breaking news. You have an entire other bonus sheet that can appear in the list slot of the big score that are all at mythic rare.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even if the cards are not very good, they're going to be several dollars. So the good ones are going to be ridiculously expensive, not because they're that good or they're that valuable or that wanted in decks, but simply because you can't get your hands on any of them.
And then we're going to see the Assassin's Creed. Like we mentioned earlier, they are just going to be doing Beyond boosters and Collector boosters.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Commander decks coming with the set because they expected it to be a Aftermath-style set, and it sounds like there just wasn't enough time and bandwidth to create a full set of cards for the Assassin's Creed. There's plenty of stuff that you could have done with the Assassin's Creed, even mm-hmm. just like there's so many reprints that you could have done to fill, you know, the whole reprint slot of the set.
Look what they did. Warhammer 40K was ridiculously popular, and the decks were powerful, and people loved that.
Yeah.
The Lord of the Rings Commander decks are fantastic, and people love them, and they're very powerful. It's just the arrogance to think, oh, I have this idea for Aftermath where we're going to only have mythic rares, rares, and uncommons, and we're going to cut the number of cards in the pack in half by getting rid of all the commons. And people are going to be so in love with it, and it's going to make so much money because we're going to have half the printing cost, and we're going to sell it for the same or more. And people were like, why the fuck would we buy these?
Mm-hmm. And then especially when you bought them and started opening the packs, because we opened an entire box. There are plenty of people you can go watch online.
I want to note, the only reason we bought a box is because we were able to get a box for like $40.
Oh, yeah. We bought it several months later.
Yes.
When it was cheaper. And
it's still at that price. You still can get it for stupid cheap. And even at that cheap price, even with chase cards like Nissa, they are like $17. Even with Karn, mm-hmm. even with these mythics that you can reasonably pull because there's like 50 cards total in the set, even with that, the $40 is still not worth it.
Because then you're only open, you only have the possibility to open up these 50 cards, but you're not going to get the chase cards because they're filled with the other 30 cards.
Yeah.
And so you just open up the same cards over and over.
It's like 5 copies of Tolarian Contempt.
And the reason that people enjoy opening packs is because, well, it's gambling. Gambling's addictive. But still, it's that excitement, that fun of not knowing what you're going to get, and even, you know, like there, you can even pop open some, you know, lower power, lower rarity things that are still good, still valuable, while, you know, you're opening up for the top end. Mm-hmm. And that's what's exciting, is opening up, riffling through the cards. But when you're like, haha, and there's nothing. Okay.
It's the exact same thing that I got in the last 3 packs. Great.
Yeah.
That was so arrogant of them. And they were like, this is going to be so good. We're going to start designing all of our sets around having this, which is why you had, like, a crazy bonus sheet for Lost Caverns of Ixalan and a crazy bonus sheet situation for Thunder Junction and an entire set built around it. And it was so... This is also the set that they sent the Pinkertons after a creator for. Right. Was the Aftermath set. Ludicrous shit. I hope that we get someone a little bit more level-headed and a little bit more reasonable. Someone that can actually turn shit around. But I will not have hope for that until we see it in action.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Moving on. Daggerheart has released their first major update with Daggerheart version 1.3 for beta testing. This was about a little over a week and a half ago, as we release the podcast every other week. Can't always be up to date on certain things. It's okay. But this is the first one that has some major rules changes for the game. Currently, there's been some decoupling of the damage and the stress mechanics. There's also a change to GM moves and fear, as well as several game-wide balancing mechanics. We're not going to go through everything, but we are going to go through some of the universal changes. Damage thresholds. They adjusted the damage thresholds across all classes, and then stress points are no longer marked when you take damage below your minor threshold. Simplifies the armor threshold hit point decision-making process during combat. Who's been harping on that? This guy. Simplified it a little bit. Nothing too crazy. They also wanted to decouple it from stress, mm-hmm. simply because there are a lot of game features and class features that utilize stress as a resource.
Yeah.
And when you're marking it for damage, you're just pulling away a resource that they could be using for other game actions, which isn't fun. We also have the GM moves and fear. It changed GM role structure. So you can now choose to make a move or take fear on rolls with fear. Not both. This reduces the fear economy and impacts the balance of if/how much fear is spent on adversary moves. Also streamlined what can be spent on fear, taking weight off of the GM side of play. Simplifying GM play, a little bit less in the resource, but also a bit more efficient with the resource usage and limiting the options a little bit. The last major change, we'll go over a couple more later, is the stress points. The starting number of stress point slots for all players is now 6, and they are no longer marked when below the minor threshold. So you have a little bit more utility with that resource. Those are the big changes going on with Daggerheart. What do you think, Sam?
So we were going to play a beta test of the Daggerheart. Ended up falling through
sickness,
illness. Yes. So it's hard to say how these changes feel. I think that I like the simplification of things on the GM side. In the first place, there wasn't a huge amount of things, but there did feel like a few too many things you could do with fear. And a lot of it came down to kind of using fear to justify special actions that you were as the GM were doing, because this system is built to make the characters feel very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And using fear, and I can get the sense of one, it you know, when you fail, when you whatever with fear, then the GM gets to immediately make a move and bank it for later, does feel like it's a little much.
Yeah. It was one of those when you saw it in action with the playtest game that they showed on Critical Role, Matt was able to pull off some very powerful game warping moves that in the hands of a less experienced GM or one that might be a bit more adversarial with their party could very easily take over the game from the players. So I think simplifying that and kind of limiting the options a little bit and streamlining it is just going to be better for the game overall, because you're not going to have a Matt Mercer running your table.
No. Yeah, you have to be very judicious with how with what you do, and you know, not in Daggerheart alone, but in any sort of GM role. And I think that's this is mechanically limiting it without without chaining the DM to the table. You know?
Yes. Yes. So those changes, I think, are going to be very welcome. There's also a lot of minutiae in a lot of the classes of things being renamed or slightly modified. Some of the major changes to the document itself, they are doing chapters instead of parts, and they've also kind of rearranged what stuff goes where a little bit, just to make it a little bit more flow a little bit better in each section. They've also added some stuff to the introduction section and changed up and added some more wordings. We also have a new section for rulings over rules, because they want to emphasize more the ruling of the game master and emphasize that over the actual specific written rules of the game. That's kind of more just to emphasize what the core of the game is about, which is about the narrative and the storytelling, and not rules luring and not power gaming as much.
Yeah.
Obviously, people are going to ignore that in a lot of ways.
It comes down to that there are so many different ways to play, and everybody likes something different out of the game, you know?
They renamed the safety tools for... They made a new session zero and safety tools section, as opposed to simply a table for all, just a little bit more readable. Moved all those resources to another section, which is fine. Obviously, a whole bunch of changes to the domain cards, the various classes, ancestries, all that kind of stuff. When it comes down to playing, they've done some changes for action roles and group action roles and help and all that kind of stuff. Damage roles are changed a little bit, mostly clarifications for rules text. But one of the biggest changes for actually playing the game is the advantage-disadvantage system. So previously it was you were going to roll the 2d12, one hope, one fear, and then if you had advantage, you were going to add a d6 to that roll. And if you had disadvantage, you're going to subtract a d6 from the total roll. What it is now... Instead of the D6, you're going to roll an additional hope dice.
Yes.
So if you have advantage, you roll the additional hope dice, and then you take the higher roll on the hope dice. With disadvantage, you roll an additional hope dice, and you take the lower of the hope dice roll. So this will advantage-disadvantage system will influence more the rolling with hope versus the rolling with fear aspect of the game. And it'll feel much more like the advantage-disadvantage system in a lot of other systems that people might be more familiar with, and you don't simply just have to add an additional dice to the roll.
Yeah, it both fixes the problem or the desire to have the advantage be a bigger number to help you succeed, but this also helps you succeed more likely with hope. And the disadvantage, yes, you're going to decrease the chances of success, but you're also going to increase the chances of failing with fear, which kind of takes that entire gambit and makes the two makes the advantage more advantageous and the disadvantage more extreme.
One of the other more major things that I want to highlight is the hidden condition. Now, instead of just being able to become hidden, you have to spend stress to gain the hidden condition. And then, yeah, obviously the same things. If you attack a target, then you're no longer hidden, that kind of that stuff. So just much like the problem with the rogue, where they can just hide as a bonus action forever and ever and ever. Now, like, hiding requires physical exertion.
Yes.
And you can't just hide indefinitely as a bonus action all the time in the middle of combat. That would be ridiculous. So kind of mechanizing that a little bit, I think, is... totally fine. They rebalanced a lot of the weapons and equipment, pretty much everything. Armor, everybody starts with 6 armor slots, and you can't switch armor in danger or under pressure, and you cannot carry additional armor in your inventory anymore. I think just having more slots is probably better
the way to
across
go.
The board, and then you don't have to worry about people trying to power game it and swap out armors and carry things in their inventory and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, those are some of the major questions. They have an entire change log associated with every single chapter in the game, as well as card updates specifically for the domains, the communities, all that kind of stuff. You can check all of that out at daggerheart.com. They make it very readily accessible. And I believe the new quick start adventure and full playtest materials have been updated to the version 1.3 version as well, if you so desire to play with them. Do you have anything else you want to say about Daggerheart?
I'm waiting for 1.4 when they start requiring stress tokens to make a phone call, because that's what my day-to-day life is like.
Okay. Okay. That's fine. That's fine. Modern Horizons 3, there's been some leaks. So when they spoiled Modern Horizons 3 earlier when they did the big live stream, yes, spring. We got to see a preview for a Johnny Nicodle Pariah, which is a flip walker, as they are colloquially known. This was a cycle that started a while ago. We saw it with Liliana and I believe Jace.
And Chandra.
And Chandra.
And I think one more.
Was it Nyssa?
Yes, Nyssa.
And what they are cards that you cast as a creature on one side, and then you have to meet some kind of requirement that you can then flip to their backside where they're a planeswalker, telling the story of how they got their spark, very flavorful, and the cards generally are rather powerful as well. And Ajani Nicodle Pariah was one of the cards we saw. We talked about it previously. I thought it was very powerful. I'm a little bit colder on the card now. I still think it's good.
It's still a good card.
Still a good card. Very well costed for 2 mana. All the creatures are very well costed. And we also saw the art for Tamio, both pre and post spark, post planeswalkering, if you will. But we have actual leaks for some of these, like blurry image leaks, not like the fake Wizards of the Coast spoiler season leaks, where they just kind of start showing the cards off from the set. But we are getting close to Modern Horizons 3, so we probably will be getting full spoilers here in the near future. But we have seen Tamio, we have seen Sorin, we have seen Rahl, and we have seen Grist now in their Flipwalker forms. We're going to go over them now. We first have Tamio, Inquisitive Student, which is the creature side, for a single blue mana. She is flying when she attacks. You investigate, which is create a clue token, and then when you draw your third card on a turn, you exile her, returning her to the battlefield transformed to her planeswalker side. She's also a 0/3, I didn't mention that. And Tamio, Seasoned Scholar, is green-blue, legendary planeswalker. +2, you can, until your next turn, whenever a creature attacks you or a planeswalker you control, it gets -1/-0 until end of turn. You can -3 her to return a target instant or sorcery spell from your graveyard to your hand. If it's green, you add a mana of any color, and you can -7 her to draw cards equal to half the number of cards in your library, rounded down, and you get an emblem with you have no maximum hand size. Her starting loyalty is 2. So it will take you 3 upticks of her +2 loyalty ability to be able to alt her to draw half your library and have no maximum hand size for the rest of the game. That's a very powerful walker. It's a 1-mana creature that's got a big old booty.
Yeah.
And flying. So flying. A 0/3 1-mana flying creature for blocking. When she attacks, she creates a clue token, which I find interesting because she's a 0/3. But if you're drawing a lot of cards, which you probably are going to be doing in Simic, it'll be very easy to flip her.
Mm-hmm.
I think of the Planeswalker halves, her plus ability is probably by far the weakest. And -3, I think, is a little bit overcost to get an instant sorcery card back to your hand, though it does generate a mana if it is a green card. But that -7 ability is stupid powerful.
It's one of those that I think we were discussing a little earlier. Probably some ridiculous things that can be done for it, and once somebody solves the card, it'll be like, oh, okay, that's why that's a -3, and suddly green, blue-green storm.
Yeah, I agree. It'll be very powerful. This is probably my least favorite of the Flipwalkers we've seen,
though. Yeah, I'm not huge on this one. Also not my playstyle in general, so.
That's fair. But something that is decidedly more my playstyle, Sorin of House Markov and Sorin the Ravenous Neonate. Sorin of House Markov is a 1-black legendary creature human noble, 1/4. Very well cost.
Yeah.
2-mana 1/4 with lifelink and extort. So whenever you cast a spell, you can choose to pay white or black, and if you do, each opponent loses a life and you gain that much life. Extort is a very powerful ability in Commander. At the beginning of your post-combat main phase, if you gained 3 or more life this turn, you exile him and then return him to the battlefield transformed into his planeswalker side, which I want to note. If you cast a single card and you extort it in a Commander game, each opponent loses 1 life and then you gain 3.
Yep.
So all you need to do is extort a spell once and you'll be able to flip him. Sorin Ravidus Neonate is a legendary planeswalker. Sorin, extort, as well as a static ability. Static abilities on planeswalkers are very good, with a beginning loyalty of 3. You can plus 2 to create a food token. I hope there is a delicious vampiric branded food token.
Oh, that yeah.
In the set
sure.
as well.
For sure.
And then you have a minus 1 where he deals damage equal to the amount of life you have gained that turn to any target, player, creature, battle, opposing planeswalkers. A very powerful minus 1 ability. And then a minus 6 ability to gain control of a target creature. It becomes a vampire in addition to its other types, and then you can put a lifelink counter on it if you control a white permanent other than that creature that you're gaining control of, or Sorin himself. This is probably, in my estimation, one of the more powerful planeswalkers from the Flipwalker set or cycle that we're getting here.
It is right in that Orzhov, tunnel of things to do with life gain. Not a huge amount of Orzhov things that create food tokens. Mm-hmm. I mean, more so after Wilds of Eldraine and Lord of the Rings, but still, food on a Sorin, interesting. But yeah, even that minus one ability is going to, it could very easily rack you up a lot of damage on your opponents if you've been gaining a lot of life in a given turn.
Also, if you extort 2 spells, that's 6 damage you can be throwing around the table, which is going to get rid of a lot of threats. Even if you extort a single spell, that becomes a lightning bolt.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like, that is a very powerful ability. Having extort on both sides is very powerful. Obviously, I have a bias towards the vampires.
Yeah.
But he is a human noble and then a planeswalker, so technically he's not a vampire, but he does become...
Also true.
He does become a vampire when he gets his spark, so that's a whole other thing. I like Sorin the most, by far. The next one's pretty good, too. Rall, who is on his front side, Rall, Monsoon Mage, 1 and a red for a legendary creature, human wizard. 1-3. With the static ability of instant and sorcery spells you cast cost 1 less to cast. That in and of itself would be a fantastic card.
Yeah,
sure. A 2-mana red 1-3. It's got a big booty, so it's a good blocker, and it reduces the cost of all your instant and sorceries. Good card. Probably one of the more difficult ones to flip, though. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell during your turn, you flip a coin. If you lose the flip, Rall deals 1 damage to you. If you win the flip, you can exile him and return him to the battlefield transformed, where you get Rall, Leyline Prodigy, Legendary Planeswalker. Rall enters the battlefield with additional loyalty counters on him for each instant and sorcery spell you've cast this turn. So, if you're losing your flips and you're getting the damage dealt to you, you are then able to flip him when you do succeed on that turn with more loyalty counters. Because he does start with only 2 loyalty counters, and he has only a plus 1, mm-hmm. which is until your next turn, instant and sorcery spells you cast cost 1 less to cast. So now instead of a static reduction in cost for instants and sorceries, it has to be a plus 1. His minus 2 is deals 2 damage divided as you choose among 1 or 2 targets. You draw a card. If you control a blue permanent other than Rall, you also get a minus 8 for his ultimate, which is exile the top 8 cards of your library. You may cast instant and sorcery spells from among them this turn without paying their mana costs. If you have a storm strategy, as you had mentioned before we started recording, it could be very easy. It would require a little bit of luck in losing some rolls. Because this is a whenever, so it is a triggered ability. So even if you throw a bunch of spells on the stack, he will flip before a lot of those spells resolve.
You could also make sure to have, if for example, if you're using him as your commander, probably not if you're having him in the 9-9, but if he was your commander, you'd probably include the couple of cards that say when you flip a coin, you get to, you know, flip 2 and take
Krark,
your choice. Yeah, Krark
Slum. That kind of stuff. I feel like this would go quite well in Krark Sakashima partner decks.
Or heads I win, tails you lose.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. A lot of coin flipping will go a long way. The one problem I have with this, I love the static ability of and the plus 1 ability on the planeswalker for cost reduction of instants and sorceries. The damage for the minus 2 is whatever it is. You're kind of mostly doing that to draw a card because you really don't want to be doing that unless you have a blue permanent so you can get the card draw off of it. That's where I think it becomes valuable. And it can also get rid of some pesky
sure.
creatures, your Ragavans, your Docksides, your whatever. Dockside, by the time it enters the battlefield, is already a problem.
Doesn't matter.
But my biggest issue is the starting loyalty of 2, so you can't immediately minus 2 him and keep him around. That's my biggest thing. He does enter with... He's guaranteed to enter...
We'll start with, at least 3 because of the...
You'll
have at least cast one spell in order to flip him.
Exactly. So he will effectively start with 3. That is true. But I still think that it is a little bit low. I wouldn't mind if his ultimate cost 1 less.
Fair.
2 less, something like that. But the minus 8 to exile 8 and get possibly up to 8 free casts. Fair enough. It is a very powerful ability. If you hit a lot of instants and sorceries off the top. But the whole theme of him is a little bit luck.
True.
I'm okay with that. I think it's on theme. Probably my second favorite, but I think objectively the most powerful one is Grist.
I think Grist is my favorite.
Oh, absolutely. He does everything that you like doing. Grist Voracious Larva is a single green mana for a legendary creature insect, a 2/1 with death touch.
1/2.
A 1/2 with death touch. 1/2 with death touch. Whenever Grist Voracious Larva or another creature enters the battlefield under your control, if it entered from your graveyard or you cast it from your graveyard, you may pay a green mana. If you do, exile him, return him to the battlefield flipped to his planeswalker side. Grist, the Plague Swarm, legendary planeswalker Grist with starting loyalty of 3, you can +1 him to create a 1/1 black and green insect creature token, then mill 2 cards. Put a death touch counter on the token if a black card was milled this way. -2 to destroy an artifact or enchantment, and then -6 for his ultimate. For each creature card in your graveyard, create a token that's a copy of it, except it's a 1/1 black and green insect. Mass graveyard reanimation.
Mm-hmm.
While also not actually reanimating them, so you can still do things like Liliana's Dreadhorde.
Yeah.
And I think that's the right card.
Invasion of the Dreadhorde?
Invasion of the Dreadhorde, yeah.
Dreadhorde Invasion.
Dreadhorde Invasion.
Or any other mass reanimation spell, or you can Feldon to copy things in there, or you can Slimefoot and Squee to dive in and pull them out.
I think this would go very well in your Slimefoot and Squee. The +1, just the +1 to mill. You like it.
I like it.
I know you like it. It'd be very easy to flip him in a...
Oh, absolutely.
As well. Not really what I'm trying to do with my decks. I don't really have a graveyard recursion thing. So obviously you like Grist.
I like Grist.
I like Sorin.
You like Sorin.
Rao's pretty cool. Tamio, I think, is a little bit underpowered. But we're going to be... It seems like we're getting a proper Flipwalker cycle here for Modern Horizons 3, which I think will go... Sorry, Modern Commander Horizons 3.
Well, with that, we have 5. So, hypothetically... Either they finish, it's half of the color pairings.
That's true.
Yeah, Boros, Boros. Yeah. Wow.
The previous Golgari. Ones, the previous ones were all the monocolor
flipwalkers
as well.
Yeah.
Man, things are gonna get ridiculous. I like the flipwalker archetype as a whole.
Yeah, I think it's cool.
It's cool. Some of them aren't as powerful. It's one of those things that a creature has to stick around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much more, I feel like, commander, like casual commander powerful and not like powerful commander powerful. But
I'm excited to see when all of the different, commander gameplay shows do a battle of the flipwalkers.
It's that'll
be fun. We've each chosen a flipwalker and built a deck around it.
That'll be fun. But moving on, we have a Cowboy Bebop promo card cycle that they're going to be releasing in the fall and next year. Jesus. They're promoting Standard. Thank God.
Standard showdown events held at local game stores.
For the first time in a very long time. This will begin on August 2nd. That is the weekend of Gen Con. Yay. Exciting. Yeah. But you can get Cowboy Bebop promo cards by playing in the weekly Standard showdown events held at your local WPN stores. There are 5 special promo cards. All of them are in traditional foil, and each will be distributed during those Standard showdown events beginning in August. The first one, August 2nd to September 19th, is Ossification. That's the one in a white enchantment aura where you enchant a basic land you control, and then when it enters the battlefield, you exile a target creature or planeswalker an opponent controls until it leaves the battlefield. Classic enchantment removal. And an enchantment for removal.
Yes.
For exiling. The next one you have September 27th to November 7th for Disdainful Stroke. One in a blue, instant, counter-target spell with mana value 4 or greater. Then, November 15th to January 30th of 2025, you have Go for the Throat. One in a black for an instant, destroy target, non-artifact creature. February 7th to March 2nd of next year, you get Lightning Strike. One in a red, instant, deals 3 damage to any target. And then lastly, the Snakeskin Veil, April 4th to May 29th of next year, 2025, instant speed, 1 green mana, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature, gains hexproof until the end of turn. All cards that see a very good amount of play in Standard. I love that.
You know, they've been trying to fix Standard for a while now. Last year they extended the rotation.
I would argue that made the Standard problem worse, arguably.
But yeah, so if you got a Standard deck, head on down to your local Wizards partner network store and grab you some neat looking cards.
Yeah, if you play standard every week, for one, God bless you. God bless you. But if you're playing every week, you're going to be getting more than a playset of all of these promos.
Yeah,
which is pretty fun.
You could eat them instead.
Yeah, they're probably going to hold a fair bit more value. None of them are expensive cards.
No.
To buy. So I think that'll be fun. Very cool.
They also did a animated promotion. You can find that on YouTube. It uses the Thunder Junction characters and does it to the Cowboy Bebop theme and animation style.
The Cowboy Bebop promos also, they use the Thunder Junction characters, but in the art style and poses from Cowboy Bebop. So you got Tiny Bones on Ossification. You got Oko on Disdainful Strokes. You got Rakdos on Go for the Throat. Don't know who that is on...
I'm not sure whose that is.
It's a blade on Lightning Strike. I don't know what that is.
That is the Thunder Guns, I think, from Outlaw.
Oh.
From the plane.
And then you got Vraska on the Snakeskin Veil. So.
Which makes sense because she's a snake.
She's Medusa. She's Medusa. All right, the last little thing. Sam threw this in.
So of course this year is the 50th anniversary of Dungeons and Dragons. And they have been announcing all sorts of collaborations. They got one going with Lego that we talked about last time. Well, another one they have is Converse.
Wide variety of shoes for Dungeons & Dragons, as well as some apparel. I am not a shoe person at all, so I could not give less of a fuck about this. But
I mean, Chucks are a classic shoe from around the time that D&D was coming out as well, and they're cool. They're cool looking, but they're, you know, the price of Chucks, about 100.
Chuck Taylor All-Star, I think, is the cheap, or sorry, yeah, Chuck Taylor All-Star one strap for $55 is the cheapest one.
Yeah, most are about $110, $95 to $110. That's just fun. That's just neat.
You gonna get any?
No, I don't have it
not in the budget.
Not in the budget.
Would you want one?
Not going to go out of my way for it.
You're not a Converse person, are you?
Oh, yeah, my wife has Converse.
You have Converse? I don't. I have a Nike. A very basic Nike, but...
That's what I've said about you for years. You're a basic Nike.
That is a thing to say about me, but... That is all the news that we have for this episode of the Duels and Mana Dorks podcast. We will then end this podcast as we end every podcast with questions, comments, concerns, thoughts, and or ideas from... the TikTok live chat, because we record this live every week on TikTok. We'll also eventually start taking questions from the Patreon and the like. But Sam, what do we got?
A person that sometimes pops into our chat, and we always remember, it's America asking us if we're still not shredding our cards.
No, we are not shredding our cards. Wow, that's been a while since they popped in. That's crazy. No, I would not. I would never do that. Looking at the wall of cards that are valuable. No, I will not be doing that with my mana crypt that I pulled from Lost Caverns of Ixalan.
Yeah.
I will not be doing that.
Other than that, ActionDK22 asks, do you know why Planequake is going for a lot of money?
No. It's probably difficult to get. Is that one of the big score cards?
Let's...
Planequake?
We have Planequake.
Plane Quake, MTG, Planequake, Mystery Booster Convention Edition. That would probably be why. Yeah, $30. Yeah, it's looks like what? Yeah, it's a special rarity card that you get from the Mystery Booster Conventions, which are boosters you can only get at conventions. So that would be why.
I will say, if you look down the marketing price history,
spiked up recently.
Spiked
in
up
February. Interesting. What is it? Deals X damage to each creature without flying, and each planeswalker of X is 10 or more. Open the Uncovered Cavern plot booster. What the fuck? These playtest cards are wild, man.
They are.
Absolutely wild.
They are. Anyway, that's about all. MTG Crazy 345 says they love the art wall. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Oh my god, what are they? The Displate.
Displate.
There we go.
Displate and Datplate.
Let's see. Planequake, MTG Finance. Why is this card being bought and spiking out of nowhere? Yeah, his plot was a mentioned mechanic from the upcoming Outlaws of Thunder Junction set. Inside information, or someone was huffing too much glue.
I vote for huffing glue.
Yeah.
Reddit is unhinged.
I imagine it was a plot booster thing. Hold on, what is a plot booster?
We're learning so much.
We're
right
going.
Now.
This is the internet rabbit hole. Concept used in legacy style board games. Unknown element added to a certain game and thereby changing certain rules. Connection with Magic the Gathering refers to named Uncovered Cavern was first mentioned in the playtest card Planequake in the Mystery Booster set. No such booster pack is part of that set in reality, much like Contraptions weren't a part of Future Sight, though it was mentioned in the Steam Flogger boss. Maybe assumed the plot booster would be opened. It's mysterious. So it's kind of like how the booster tutor.
Yeah.
Where you open a booster pack and then you can add one of the cards to your hand. But yeah, I suspect that the people started buying it because of plot. Would be my guess. But
how
I don't
silly.
Know.
How silly.
That's the one that makes the most logical sense for me. Or there's insider trading and someone knows something that we don't.
Or someone's huffing glue.
That's kind of hot. Both of those options are kind of hot when you think about it.
Don't huff glue.
Yeah, think about it.
Nope.
Think about it, though. That's kind of hot.
I'm not going to huff glue.
That's hot. It's hot, though. It's hot. It's getting to be summer. The window's open. People have probably been hearing all the fucking cars and shit going up and down on the podcast, like right now. That one was squeaky.
It was.
Yeah. Anyway, so.
Yeah. Well,
next time we need to close the window. We forgot about that until we were like happy. Whatever. Anyway, that is all we have for this, the Lord's 65th episode of the Duels and Mana Dorks podcast. The podcast goes live every other week on Wednesdays at 12:30 Eastern Standard Time. Daylight time?
Standard Eastern. Time?
Is it
Eastern Standard?
Standard? Is it standard right now?
The standard is always just the...
Yeah, whatever. Eastern Time, 12:30 every Wednesday. Catch it. Recorded live on the TikTok one day early on Tuesday at noon. Apple, Google, Spotify, YouTube Music. Leave a review. All podcast services around the globe, all that kind of stuff.
And don't forget to like and subscribe on YouTube,
of course. Anything else you'd like to say?
In the words of Fallout Boy, those dirty thoughts of me were never yours to keep.